Bonjour mes amis et bienvenue à la troisième pierre. Je m'appelle Ben Van de Velde and that is about as much French as I can manage.
Your accent made you sound, I know you said PA, which is foot, but it sounded like you said Pierre, like we've got like three people called Peter in the room.
Three Peters walk into a room and they're all like, no, I'm The Rock. And then Dwayne The Rock Johnson smashes them through the canvas. And that is how I believe the New Testament opens. Hello, ladies and gents. Welcome to your special extra bonus slice of trivia and exciting humans from history for this month. As regular listeners will know, thanks to our supporters on Patreon, you have given myself and Barry the impetus and the wherewithal and the time which you have donated in the form of money to be able to do a little bit more research and dig down into either a previous winner or a previous interesting human or thing from a previous podcast. And this month we're going all the way back to our episode with Taylor Glenn of the Drunk Women Solve Crime podcast, where we spoke about one of the most remarkable humans of modern times, a gentleman called Eugène François Vidocq. And I imagine any of our Francophone listeners are probably immediately going, yeah, that guy. Whereas any British, American, Canadian, Australian, or any of the number of other countries listeners will be going, who? Well, over the next 20 to 30 minutes, me and Barry are going to let you know about him. He is absolutely one of the most remarkable humans I have ever read about. On the way into recording today, I was talking to Barry about how I watched Hamilton on Disney Plus for the first time, and
welcome to the middle class.
I am not having that as Hamilton being part of a middle class badge of honour. I call enormous horseshit on this.
The Disney Plus subscription, though.
Mate, it's £6 a month.
I know.
That's barely around in Wetherspoons.
It's so reasonable.
It is so reasonable. Get off your self-hating high horse. It's much more entertaining when you hate yourself for being Catholic rather than for being middle class.
And for being gay.
You don't hate yourself because you're gay. You're thinking...
Thank you, Dr. Freud.
Cured. You hate your mother because you're gay. That's how it works. And that is the sort of deductive skill that today's guest... back from the dead. Hey, when you finish listening about his life, you would not be surprised that he had done that. Anyway, the reason I talk about Hamilton is because, having watched it at the weekend, and my wife, who... as many listeners will know, continues to underwhelm me with her attitudes towards all of the correct cultural things that I love. Not really into the Beatles, not really into Daniel Kitson, not hugely into reggae, didn't really enjoy Hamilton. Divorce pending in 3 to 5 decades. I know what side my bread is buttered on. But
Ben very much does not subscribe to the idea that art is subjective.
Certain things are objective, certain things are objectively excellent. And my wife summed up Hamilton as he had a bit of a sad upbringing, but then did a lot. Big whoop. But the thing with Hamilton, if you have seen it or if you haven't, the reason he's so remarkable is just because what one man doing an astonishing amount, and probably even more astonishing coming from such a humble background... I was about to say, in those days, more impressive, but frankly, in these days, when we like to pretend there is equality across the social classes, but absolutely not. Anyway, let's tell you about our pal, Jean Vidocq. He was born in the French city of Arras in 1775, and his father, Nicolas François Joseph, was a baker and a grocer, so a relatively humble, lower middle class upbringing, but it will come as no surprise to any of you, the mid-70s and early 80s were a time of fairly serious economic trouble in France, and there was a wee little French snafu in 1789 that some of you may have known about. And Vidocq, as will become apparent, was an incredibly intelligent, self-taught gentleman on many things, but his father was able to give him a good enough education. But he was quite the unruly teenager. He kept getting into fights. He was always looking for money and gambling with money and going off with soldiers at the local garrison and getting hammered. And it got to an age where him and his elder brother Francois started stealing money from the till at his father's bakery. And his brother was sent off to be an apprentice in Lille and hopefully get on the straight and narrow, where his father kept Vidocq at home and locked the till. And as a parent myself, I would like to think that that would be the end of it. However, our hero responded by stealing the family's plate and selling it at the pawn shop. He was immediately imprisoned for this, and his father hoped that by taking him straight to the authorities, he would be sort of scared onto the straight and narrow. He was not. He responded by burgling his parents' shop, stealing 2,000 francs from the till, and running away.
Oh, wow, that's a special type of pettiness, isn't it? Like, he could have burgled any shop if he wanted to, but he chose to go back home.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean,
it's the ultimate inside job.
Yeah, yeah. No, the ultimate inside job is stealing your mother's placenta. And his plan, as you know, a classic teenage plan of I'm taking my toys and running away, was to run away to the burgeoning United States of America. However, and this is a common theme that will turn up, he decided to go drinking with a sailor he met, and the next morning he woke up with all of his money stolen.
So daring but idiotic.
Yeah, I would say reckless.
Yeah.
The next part of his biography genuinely sounds like the sort of stories that Bob Dylan used to make up in the 60s to wind up journalists about what he did when he was a child. Instead of signing on to a ship, he joined a circus that was going past the town. And it didn't work very well. He was scared of the animals, he failed to master acrobatics, and they tried to strong-arm him into being part of a cannibal act, but he refused to eat live chickens on stage.
Wait, was he a chicken?
No,
if it's a cannibal act?
No.
Or did they misspell cannonball act?
Yes.
He misheard them.
Yeah. So, sorry, I've... Fair point.
So many questions.
There are so many
also,
questions.
Also, what's the entry form for joining a circus if you have no skills whatsoever like?
I mean, mate, I got into drama school, so... Do you have the charismatic ability to hold a crowd?
I will, but it'll only be as I cry at the sight of a live chicken.
Yeah, or alternatively, please step into this cannon, put this helmet on, boom, off you go. Well, I think they were trying to work him up to not actual cannibalism, to eating raw meat. So I think it was like live chicken, raw meat, person.
Yeah, okay. That's the scale.
That is the scale of consuming verboten meat in a circus setting.
Sushi lovers are just one step away from going full Hannibal Lecter. Do you know what? Literally, I am today years old for suddenly realizing that Hannibal rhymes with cannibal. It's literally, I've only just said the two words in close proximity now that I've suddenly gone, oh yeah, that's kind of clever.
I mean, it's not kind of clever. It is Dr. Zeus level rhyming.
I do not like green eggs and ham. But I do like you, Sam I Am.
Very nice. Very nice indeed. Anyway, the thing that got Vidocq thrown out of the circus was not his complete inability as a circus performer. It's because he engaged to assist in the puppet show with the chief puppeteer and his wife, and then the puppeteer caught Vidocq kissing his wife.
Oh, and some strings attached.
Quite. I mean, I kind of hope that Vidocq tried to go, that's not your wife, that's a ventriloquist. Oh, I'm so sorry. So he decided to do what many gentlemen of this era did, and he decided to enlist in the army of the new Republic of France. And he fitted in well, but he was pretty headstrong, and in his first 6 months in the army, he engaged in 15 duels, killing 2 men. And there is one story that may be apocryphal, but that one of the men he may have killed might have been his own fencing teacher.
Oof.
Which is so cool.
Darth Vader killing Obi-Wan there.
Yeah, but it sort of sounds like he was like the mad guy in the pub who was just itching for a fight everywhere, because he fought well enough to be promoted to corporal, but at one point he tried to challenge a sergeant major to a duel, and instead of accepting, he was arrested for insubordination. And do keep count on the arrests that are coming up here. Instead of facing a court-martial, he deserted. However, he still wanted to be part of the army, so instead of continuing to desert, him and one of his best mates then just signed up to a different regiment under false names. however, after he was identified as a deserter again, well, he left again, this time to cross enemy lines and sign up with the Austrians in a French royalist brigade.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, so he was really just all about the action, not really caring about what badges he was wearing. He served in the army until 1793 until he got a leg wound and then he was sent back home.
To Austria.
Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, I've been mislabeled.
Yeah.
He settled in Brussels, which at the time was under the French control, and he ended up working as a bodyguard for a gang of card sharks. At the same time he's doing this, his mother still sent him money, which I love, because mothers will always forgive and care for their son.
He was disguising himself as a Nigerian prince. Yeah.
Yes, his real name was Goodluck Vidocq. He was arrested while doing this, of course, and the thing that got him in trouble was that he didn't have identification papers because he was a deserter. He lied about his name, he called himself Rousseau, but he gave his correct birthplace. And so they sent him back there, and once he got sent back there, he was planned that he was going to be executed as a deserter. So he escaped and went back to Brussels.
At which point, the French prison system went, you know what, guys, I think we've got some holes in this.
Yeah. Yes, the French prison system was very much a cheese grater at the time.
I think these revolving doors on the prison are really...
He joined... well, you talk about revolving doors because he wound up joining another army called the Armée Roulante, which means rolling army. And they only worked by being put at the top of a hill and then just rolled down after various wheels of brie.
Led by the Grand Old Duke of York.
Of course. Well, it was actually an army of... criminals. They were a 2,000-man group of con men who travelled the country under forged orders, pretending to be a regular army division. So they were sort of like the early 19th century French A-team.
Did they hire themselves out as mercenaries, or were they just pretending to be an army unit and scrounging off people's hospitality?
As far as I know, they were basically pretending to be a real army unit. They weren't the actual army.
So they'd show up in a village and go, you need to sequester us here, we're on our way to the front.
Precisely.
That's amazing.
Great, isn't it?
2,000 people pretending to be an army. That is so good.
However, they were victims of their own success because the real army heard about that and then had to be sent to deal with them. So it was sort of a real case of excellent stand-up of, we're the real French battalion. No, we're the real French battalion. Look at me in the eyes. Have I not been sequestered in your houses? Have you not fed me delicious crackers and foie gras? Look at me, Jean-Pierre. Look at me.
So good.
So again... He went home to Lille and began a new relationship with a woman called Francine Longuet. However, she cheated on him.
Finally!
At last, you know, this bit doesn't reflect well on him. I mean, no violence does, but he both beat up her and her paramour. Ugh. He was arrested and finally stayed in prison for a while. And it's at this point that he began referring to prison as the University of Crime.
Having previously referred to it as home.
Yes. However, he got into yet more trouble at home, so back into prison. And he got in trouble there with a couple of prisoners. They basically duped him into forging early release papers. And he got into a lot of trouble there. And when the verdict arrived on them, he was sentenced to 8 years hard labour. Whilst in a hard labour camp, he taught himself savate. Do you know what savate is?
It's a type of... martial arts?
Yeah, it's a French. Right? Yeah, it's a French martial art. Essentially, it comprises of running away. it's sort of a mix. I guess it's sort of like French jiu-jitsu, really. French jiu-jitsu with a little bit of boxing.
Nice.
So he taught himself that. Obviously, tried to escape several times. Eventually, he did, right at the end, but rather than be put in prison, he was put in the galleys, which he was perfectly happy with, because he thought it would be easier to escape from a ship. And guess what, Barry? He was right! Eventually, he escaped and made his way from prison through Paris, Brussels, Anvers, and finally Rotterdam. And when he got to Rotterdam, he was like, brilliant, get aboard a ship, head to the New World. Sadly, he was shanghaied by the Dutch and became a privateer.
That's such a great sentence. I do remember that from the podcast.
Well, being shanghaied by the Dutch
and becoming a privateer.
Yeah.
That... At this point, by the way, listeners, he's about 12.
What is he, about
20-something?
Yeah, he's in his early 20s. Yeah. He was captured as a pirate, obvs, because basically great at swashbuckling, but terrible at evading the law. He escaped in March of 1800 with the aid of a prostitute.
Oh my God. It's just... Like, one of these plot lines would be enough for an entire Lifetime movie.
Oh, it absolutely would. Oh, I should point out as well, sometimes a master of disguise, and in one of his early escapes from prison, he was disguised as...
A prostitute?
No, a nun.
A nun, there we are.
There'll maybe more of that later.
he invented nuns on the run.
Yeah. He is a French Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle. I love it. He wound up in trouble back home when he argued with a musician in a local regiment who, again, had him arrested and denounced as a royalist, but a local lawyer helped get him released. How did he thank the local lawyer? You guessed it, by having a relationship with his sister. So her name was Marie-Anne Louise Chevalier, and they had a pregnancy scare, so he had to sort of get hitched quickly. But I guess luckily for him, in terms of responsibilities, she was not pregnant. However, he still took the dowry and still squandered all of that money.
Oof.
So
there's a big midlife plot twist coming up, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't worry, mate. That's coming in 20 years' time. Sit tight. He was released. He managed to escape again in March 1800. And while on the run, a gang of burglars asked Vidocq to join them. And when he refused, they informed on him to the police, and he was arrested once again.
And I imagine he just, at this point, he's showing up, and they're going, you know where you're going at this point. Yeah. He's like, second one on the left. Yeah, I know, I'll lock the door behind me.
Yeah, it's like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. Yeah. Just, you know, yeah, fine, I know the way. And it's sort of at this point that he starts to have a change of heart, possibly out of vengeance. And he writes to Napoleon's chief of police in Lyon and offers to inform on them. And the chief of police, who probably knows a bit about Vidocq, needs him to prove his loyalty. So he immediately surrenders himself, and then that convinces the chief to let him spy on the gang. So once he knows their next job, he gets himself rearrested so that he can avoid being suspected of betraying this gang. And basically, he begins to help the police tidy up the French underworld. A lot of his sort of change of heart came from being in Paris and seeing the guillotine, and I think seeing a friend guillotine, and he thought, hang on, I don't fancy much of this. And it was in and he basically started informing on people around the year 1800, but it took a full decade before he was eventually made a member of the police force.
Right.
And they'd already used an expensive Skynet. They'd already used an extensive spy network, but Vidocq's great innovation was to organise and professionalise the spy network. And they became known as La Brigade de Sûreté, the Security Brigade. And they were plainclothes police officers who operated across the entirety of Paris, and eventually the techniques that were used there were spread all across France. And I think we spoke about this on a podcast before, he introduced the science of ballistics and criminalistics. He would use things like plaster of Paris casting for shoe and footprints. He used unalterable bond paper, indelible ink, and all sorts of ways of stopping people forging documents and the like. And he was unbelievably efficient. In his time, when he started working as the head of La Sûreté, they made 811 arrests, including 15 assassins, 341 thieves, and 38 receivers of stolen property. 14 escaped prisoners were recaptured, 43 men who had broken parole were brought in, and 229 bad characters were arrested and banished from the city.
Yeah, and he became the... You mentioned that he was the head of it. He rose to sort of lead this department. It wasn't that he was just, you know, his ideas, the police took them. They trusted him enough to put him in charge of it.
Yep. My favourite thing is how he burned his cover to the criminal world. He took part on a raid on a cabaret in the suburb of Courtille, and he made every single person march out of there in single file, and he marked the ones who should be arrested with a chalk cross on their back.
Oof.
So really beautiful. And that led to the arrest of 38 people, and yeah, his exposure as a police spy. And when the underworld accused him of sort of turning on them, he said, well, you're willing to turn in evidence on each other.
Yeah.
So what does it matter if I'm doing it for the police? I think he just thought of the police as just another gang.
Yeah.
Eventually, he tried to rebuild his reputation as a policeman who gave criminals a chance. And so in time, the Surette came to be staffed with exclusively ex-criminals. Because, you know, it takes a thief.
Yeah.
This kind of shocked an awful lot of the old police establishment, but it made sense.
He could handle one of them in him, but as soon as he brought his mates along, they're like, oh no.
He had many more successes throughout the 1820s. The countryside of France had a big trouble with a group of criminals known as the chauffeurs, which means the heaters. You're going to love why they're called this. Well, in fact, you tell me, guess why they were called the heaters?
They burned the scenes of their crimes afterwards to get rid of the evidence.
No, I mean, it's a little more extreme, but basically they were called that because they would break into houses and hold the residents' feet in the fireplace until they told them the location of any valuables.
Oof.
One notorious criminal was a 72-year-old woman called Prudence Pezé, better known as the Wolf of Raincourt.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And in order to take them down, Vidocq infiltrated them, joined them on three raids, and suggested the perfect target. Like a genuine target, you know, a vulnerable old man who was very, very rich. And when they attacked it, he would entrap them, and the gang were either killed or captured. Incredible, right?
Yeah, I mean, was this old man in on the job?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so just mild trauma for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
great
or
good.
Like, obviously, morally, a little bit fishy. He had great troubles in 1824 when King Louis the 18th died and he was replaced by Charles the 10th. He was a very conservative hardliner, and the notion of a police force staffed by out-and-out criminals was clearly too much for him. And eventually, Vidocq handed in his resignation in 1827, but luckily, in 1828, it was time to release his memoirs.
Yes, I would read these.
And they were so juicy and so successful that within a year, there were two plays based on them being produced on the London stage.
In London?
In London,
oh
yeah.
Oh, my God.
And he was the subject of short stories and penny dreadfuls and things in the newspaper. It was incredible. And
around the time a young Charles Dickens would have been reading about
correct.
It?
Not just Charles Dickens, but Honor Balzac, Edgar Allan Poe, Arthur Conan Doyle, and indeed Victor Hugo. And it has been suggested that Jean Valjean is inspired by Eugène Vidocq.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Jean Valjean for Les Miserables, for those people who
don't
know it.
Sorry, yes, of course. By the 1830s, rich guy decided to do some philanthropic work. He set up a paper factory just outside Paris where all of... What are you laughing at?
Just I teetering back into the world of counterfeiting.
Yeah.
Could just see. He's like, I need a little taste. I need a taste.
Yeah, I'm sure it was temptation, but he employed lots of ex-cons... But they to try and rehabilitate
yes,
it, but they
yeah,
found
yeah.
it hard to find honest work. And so basically, because lots of people at the time thought that it was shocking employing ex-cons, so he didn't make any money from it. And in fact, by 1831, he'd been driven to bankruptcy, so he had to get back in the game. Luckily for him, the crime rate in Paris had skyrocketed in his absence. And King Charles was forced from power in the July Revolution of 1830, so Vidocq was like, baby's coming back! And in a few months, the chief of police was convinced to restore him as the head of the Surette, or maybe Surette. It didn't last long. The biggest problem for him was because he was a police official, he was seen as a protector of the monarchy, and so he was attacked a lot by the Republican press. We sort of were wowed. I was wowed. You were shocked by his entrapment techniques.
Yeah.
And again, that upset quite a lot of people. So eventually, he had to stand down. And this is the point where he sets up the Bureau de Renseignement, the world's first private detective agency. and it was mostly concerned with debt collection and helping the victims of swindlers, and he'd take a percentage of the retrieved money as commission. My favourite thing in this was he had 40 field agents who had names like the Satyr, yeah, the Cyclops, and the Man About Town.
Wow. He must have been on an off day when he got his name.
Yeah.
We've run out of mythological creatures. Well, yeah, he's just going to be some guy wandering around.
Yeah, it's like, is it going to be Cerberus?
Yeah.
Is it going to be
the Hydra? Hydra?
And he had obviously he found a little bit of time with all of these agents going about the city to even release a book called Les Voleurs, which means the thieves, and it was a non-fiction book all about the French criminal underworld, but also act as a bit of an advert for his private detection agency. Big problem for him running this was the police didn't approve of his methods, and so in 1837. The police raided his office over a national security matter. He was accused of money lending, particularly to four war ministry clerks who had also been accused of stealing secrets. And so Vidocq was arrested on charges of corruption because he'd lent money to these guys who had also been doing nefarious deeds in the government. Mm. It was an enormous trial, and eventually the case was dropped. Things got worse for him in 1842. He was very careless in investigating a fraud. After he located a fraudster called Champagne, and they escorted the man to their office, forced him to sign a declaration of his crime and accepted his debts. However, 5 days later, the police raided Vidocq's offices on the charges of false arrest, and he was sent to a place called the Conciergerie, which is nowhere near as nice as it sounds. It's one of France's most infamous prison camps. And this is 1842, so he will have been in his late 60s at this point, and the police refused to move him from there, and they refused to let his wife at the time visit him. Whilst he was in prison for 4 months, the police used it as an excuse to dig around in other things he'd been doing, and they particularly paid attention to the practice of kidnapping young women and placing them in converts at the behest of either outraged parents or cuckolded husbands.
Placing them in convents?
Convents.
Oh, right, you said converts.
Sorry, no, I don't mean...
Inserting them into former Protestant, now Catholic. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like a progenitor of the plot of Get Out.
Yeah.
And
so he'd kidnap young women and put them
in nunneries,
because their wives or boyfriends were upset with them. Or
yeah,
families.
They were either suspected of cuckolding their husbands or seen as oversexy on women.
Right.
Brilliantly, the press loved it and the French public were shocked. Not because of the kidnap of women, but because, in inverted commas, Vidocq was an enemy of love.
The French.
Yeah, the French.
And love will conquer all.
Yeah, Vidocq was found guilty, sentenced to another 5 years in prison.
Imagine his lawyer going, "My lud, I'm calling our star witness, love itself." Yeah.
And then Cupid flies in and unleashes arrows, and Vidocq escapes under a hail of arrows. He appealed. The conviction was quashed immediately within 5 minutes, saying the trial had been mishandled, but his reputation was ruined, and for the next few years, the number of clients declined. In 1848, however, it was the year of revolution across Europe, and it led to the establishment of the Second French Republic. And guess who was employed by the provisional government to deal with the public unrest? Our pal Eugène. He uncovered all sorts of plots, including plots to bomb the government.
Conveniently enough.
Yeah, this is possibly my favourite fact of his entire biography. The winner of the elections in December was a chap called Charles-Louis Napoleon. Hmm. I'm guessing a relation of old Napoleon Bonaparte.
Napoleon III, would go on to be.
Yes, he would. Now, he offered his services to Napoleon despite the fact that he had been spying on Napoleon a few months prior. Again, bringing back to Hamilton, which I've watched, he's a real sort of Aaron Burr with the moral compass, isn't he? And Napoleon politely declined. I must tell you about the last time he got imprisoned. I know we've not been keeping count, but I'm going to say it's in the 20s. He obviously tried to escape from prison as a young man, dressed as a nun. What do you think was the final reason he was sent to prison?
For impersonating a nun.
Close. Impersonating a priest.
For what purpose?
He'd been hired by a duke to try and retrieve some compromising letters from an ex-mistress. So obviously, a priest, I guess, persuading her to do confession, perhaps.
Oh, man.
But it had gone wrong and he was arrested. He was released without charge at that point. And he then, that's the point at which he sort of disappears off the map in a way, because he retires and he passes away a few years later in 1857 in Paris. But he's an absolutely remarkable man. One of my favourite things that I found is a bibliography of his own writings, which include the books Memoirs of Vidocq, The Police Spy, A Study of Thieves and Imposters, A Slang Dictionary, A Memoir of My Time as a Gang Member, and The Adventures of a Marquise, otherwise known as The True Mysteries of Paris.
That sounds like his one fiction book.
Yeah, yeah.
His agent is like, okay, now we need to, you know, do a Dame Stella Remington and write some spy fiction.
But he's an absolutely incredible man, an incredible looking man. He's got, from the picture we've got of him here, he's sort of got like a chunky Lancashire mill owner look.
Yeah.
With these wonderful, messy curls everywhere, big old lamb chops at the side. And
Hella eyebrows.
Yeah, he's got a great sort of lovable rogue vibe about him.
Yeah.
Which is hard not to have. So, yeah, I had to talk about him. I mean, we've hammered through his biography in double quick time, but clearly there's so, so much more to him. And he's a very complex figure. I don't know my ins and outs of my French history, but generally speaking, not on the side of any royal family ever.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's boinging back and forth across that divide,
yeah,
the fact that he starts off as a criminal and then serves in the army, then becomes a pirate, then becomes part of the police force, and then becomes a police spy and then a private detective. Like, it's remarkable and admirable, and his energy and entrepreneurship. He clearly could never get his feet under the table.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like entirely like he's, like, set up this police department and this private detective agency out of a sense of altruism. It's another money-making scheme in a long line of money-making schemes.
It is. I mean, I guess ultimately, and he's a high achiever, so it doesn't quite fit on the podcast, but because he is a, like, a cheerful nihilist,
yes,
I think. And the thing is with nihilism, I think sometimes it can be horrendously destructive.
Yeah.
But with him, he's one of these people who is so clever, but so lacking in obedience of any sense of rules. He just looks at the entire world and goes, how am I going to play with you today?
Yeah. But putting to use, the thing I'll say he sounds like he's got it is putting to use stuff he's learned in his previous escapades.
Yes. I believe there've been a couple of films about him in French. I don't know if there's been one in English, but he is certainly ripe for the screen. And there's the sort of person, one of my favourite things doing this podcast is finding someone who I imagine is an incredibly well-known national figure in another country. The sort of person that, I'm trying to think of a British equivalent, sort of like a Dick Turpin.
Eddie the Eagle.
Eddie, sure. But yeah, there's two perfect examples where no one outside of Great Britain would know either Edward the Eagle, as he was better known to his family, or Dick Turpin. But both of them pale in comparison to Eugène François Vidocq. And that is my third foot for this month.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ben. And thank you, listeners. And thank you especially to those of you who donate to us on patreon.com and help us make these episodes. As Ben mentioned at the start of this week's episode of the show proper, we're 2 donors away on Patreon from hitting 50 donors, which means that we will then have to start compiling our book. I say our book like it already exists. It doesn't. But, you know, if we get a couple more people donating on patreon.com/worstwoodforward, we will start putting the 170 plus episodes worth plus bonus material of this show into something you can pick up and hold in your hands and thumb through.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we get to that stage, we will want your help, particularly you Patreon donors. We're going to want to know what your favourite episodes were, what your favourite facts were, your favourite stars who have appeared in the show regularly. Pliny the Elder, all over that guy. Yeah. And
dog torture, fine, guys.
Of course, naturally. And obviously, we'll be using you as a sounding board. I'm guessing the way putting it together is going to work. There'll be a large period of collating material, and then me and Barry will go away and, you know, scribble out stories and start collecting them together in interesting ways. And we will inevitably let you, the Patreon donors, get first dibs on little slivers of chapters and introductions and all of that sort of stuff. That almost sounded professional and like I was on top of my brief until the last clause.
We could just hear the ellipsis there at the end.
But Barry is slightly doing us down. We have made some preliminary plans about the book, but once we get those last few donors, A, we'll be putting the foot to the accelerator, because the number of people I've spoken to and said, we're going to try and make a book of the podcast, and they're like, of course, it's a great idea, as they try and fuel the fire of our own rampant egotism. And also, when we hit that next goal, I think we have one further one, but it was to do with touring, which obviously a little bit tricky now. So when we hit that goal, me and Barry are going to put our heads together and think of what our next goal as a podcast can be, because obviously we'd like more support and we'd like to grow the show. So if you have any ideas of what other things you might like from us, do let us know.
Yeah.
And you can get in contact with us on @worstfoot on Twitter, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I am on @BenVanderveld. He...
At Bazmax Day. Sorry, he pointed at me and I wasn't prepared for that.
He was not paying attention. Yeah. And also, since this is going out in the next day or two, I will also give another shout out to my comedy club, @GoodShipComedy. If you are in and around South London, specifically Wandsworth, on August the 6th, you can come to our first live show in 5 months. We are at the Royal Victoria Patriotic Building, and we are putting on a show with former pod guest Sindhu V, Susie Ruffle and Jake Lambert. I will be hosting it unless my wife goes into labour, and you would be very welcome to go see it. There'll be a link in the comments to this podcast, or just type Good Ship Comedy into ctickets.com. There's only about 50 or so tickets left, so I'd hurry up and get on it if you want to come and watch an actual live comedy show. We are going to be giddy with delight.
I think that's it for now.
I think it is.
Thank you all very much for listening as ever, and back to what you were doing. Carry on. We'll be observing quietly from a distance, taking notes. Bye.
Bye.